You're listening to another great podcast in the MyMac Podcasting Network.
It's Geeks Pub time. I'm Tim Robertson. Over there is David Cohen. Hello, David.
Hello.
It's the first, or well, yesterday was the 1st of February, 2025. See, I got the decade right. And yep. Speaking of decades, we are starting a new bracket, but we're thinking about renaming it Face Off. What do you think? Brackets doesn't mean anything. I mean, I've always called it brackets because I used a website that made brackets. So I just...
Well, also as well, brackets are very much an American term because it's an American sports thing that while we have them here, we certainly don't call them brackets. So maybe in the interest of our non-US audience, we should choose the different term so people have an idea what it is. Because bracket, as like you say, bracket doesn't really mean much, whereas face-off actually tells you what it is, which is a series of items that are facing off against each other.
Yeah, I thought so too. So yeah. We're going to go in a different direction with our face-off. And this time, and we've talked about this on Tech Fan, I think we talked about it on the last episode of Geeks Pub, where we're getting out of the comic book kind of superhero genre stuff, and we're moving into decades. So for this episode, we're going to start in the 80s, and we picked 80 movies, not TV shows, because they pretty much sucked in the 80s. And we're going with movies, and then we'll do the 90s, the 2000s, the 2010s. We'll probably won't do the 2020s because, you know, we're only half of the decade in, but I don't know, maybe we will. But the point is, we're trying to figure out what was the best of each decade. Now, it's kind of a random drawing, the ones that are picked for our bracket. I'm looking at Wikipedia and different lists and stuff, and I'm just taking randomly from these lists that I'm finding of movies from each decade. So that's how we have our competitors, if you will, David.
Okay. Yeah. Works for me. I mean, it's all random anyway.
Yeah, including the winners, kind of, sometimes.
Well, and our memories and everything are also random. Yeah. So,
I have a feeling we might have to flip a coin on a couple of these. I don't know. I don't know what you like more or not.
The problem is when you do nostalgia stuff, then there's different nostalgias means different things to different people, and that can affect your view of it. We just talked about before we start, there's a couple of things on here that I've never seen. And obviously that kind of disadvantages them. It's difficult to go, oh yeah, that's the best thing ever when I haven't seen it. So we may need to have some debates about that.
Yep. And I did share the link to we're using Google spreadsheet now. I was using a bracket software and I created this whole thing and it looks like it didn't save it. So that's what you get when you get some unknown company's website and you try to use it. And it was clunky anyways. So you have access to the spreadsheet.
Oh, how exciting.
Isn't that exciting?
There's nothing I love more than an online spreadsheet. It really gets my juices flowing.
You know, there are some spreadsheet cowboys out there. There really are. Every now and then I'll come across them on TikTok where they have a TikTok video of what they're doing in spreadsheets. And most of it is way beyond me. I'm like, it's not feasible for me to care less about their content when they're talking about that stuff. It's not physically possible.
Well, there was I saw an article on The Verge a couple of weeks ago. It was the World Excel Championships, where they actually have a competition where they're given some sort of economics problem and they have to design a spreadsheet to solve it under time. And the winner gets like a big reward, you know. And I just try and kind of think, wonder what that reward might be. And that's the sort of competition, if you win, you don't want to tell anyone.
No. Is there a way to change the color of, like, go dark mode with a spreadsheet on Google spreadsheet?
Oh, I have no idea. I really don't use Google, but I know they only just added that feature to Excel, and Excel's existed for what, nearly 40 years, so probably not.
I know I can change the color of each cell, but I want to change.
You want to make the whole thing dark, because otherwise it's blasting in your eyes.
And this is doing that right now.
This is why I don't tend to run a computer while we're recording because I don't want to see my eyeballs for an
hour. It's harshing my buzz, dude.
Yeah.
Again, I don't see that it does it.
No.
I'm not happy about that.
How dare Google give you their free Office class software and not give you a feature you want?
Oh, you can do meetings right from within Google now.
Oh, fantastic.
Isn't that fantastic? So, that's
amazing.
Let's talk about something that is more amazing, and that is a movie that was released online this last week that when I saw the previews for this movie, I was excited, David. I really wanted to dig this movie. And it's Star Trek Section 31.
Right. So I am amazed by this because it took really... I mean, as we've talked about before, Star Trek Discovery was uneven. I think we could both agree. We both really enjoyed it, but there were parts of it that were terrible.
No, I didn't enjoy it.
You didn't enjoy it at all?
I put up with it. No, it was just bad. The last season was probably the best season.
Right. Well, okay. Maybe I enjoyed it a little bit more than you, but it definitely had bits that were quite bad. And they took one of the best parts of Discovery and they put it in a standalone movie. And
in the very first episode, the Michael, the main character, I still don't know why Michael is a woman. That's a male name. I don't know any females named Michael, but okay, whatever. I eventually got past that, even though it still kind of bugs me a little bit. That'd be like a woman named Tim. I've got problems with that. Or David, for that matter.
Yep.
But she's got a captain who she really respects, who dies in the very first episode.
Yep.
And that's kind of what sets off the series. But then they find the evil twin from the evil Star Trek universe, which...
What was I watching the other day? I mentioned... that I just finished the second season of Star Trek Prodigy, which actually is a hugely underrated show. I know you struggle with it. Once you get past the first half season, when it moves away from the Nickelodeon kiddie stuff to actually become kind of the it becomes to Star Trek Voyager what Picard was to the Next Generation. Yeah, it actually is really good. But in the second season, they end up for a few minutes in the Mirror Universe and... they have on the ships, they have Cetacean Ops, which is lower decks had this as well. It was a throwback to Star Trek 4. So they actually have whales in big tanks on the ships. And in the Mirror Universe, even the whales are evil. And I love that.
Did they have goatees and mustaches?
They didn't have goatees, but that, because if they'd had goatees, that would have ruined the joke when they find out the whales are evil. But yeah, I mean, they can't believe it. Even the whales are evil here, and it was really funny. But yeah, the Mirror Universe is basically our universe, but everybody's evil.
Yeah,
often with a goatee.
Yeah,
yeah.
I never understood that. Okay, it's the evil universe, but yet how could everybody be evil? Love doesn't exist. Every single thing is bad.
Makes no sense. Let's face it. I mean, it came from the original series, and it was a writer's idea to, let's allow the characters to play bad for a while. They always do. All sci-fi shows like to do this. They have an alternate universe where people are different, and it just allows the actors to play against type and have some fun for a week.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway. What's her name? Michelle Yeoh's character, who we were kind of surprised because we thought, first of all, she even when she was in that first season, that first episode of Discovery, we were all kind of going, well, she's kind of expensive for a Star Trek show. And then, of course, she dies off and you think, oh, well that's why. And then she came back as her evil twin. And there was a whole lot of Mirror Universe shenanigans that went on. Turned out the whole season was all revolved around the Mirror Universe. Sorry for spoilers for anybody. They did the whole kind of, bad but trying to reform arc with her. And because of the way Michelle Yeoh played her, it was fantastic. Because she... You never really... It wasn't the obvious thing where you kind of think, okay, she's going to turn in from evil to anti-hero to genuinely respected hero, which is normally the arc. They never really did that with her. She was always anti-hero and could betray you any time.
Yep, absolutely.
And she hung around for a couple of seasons, and then she left, and she went
through... Well, she didn't leave. They went to the future.
They went to the future, but then she was in the future with them, and she couldn't do that, so then they had to throw her through the garden right. forever. And at the time, they said they were going to do a Section 31 spin-off show. And Section 31 is kind of the Starfleet deniable Black Ops. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're the people who do the stuff that Starfleet can't or won't do, but sometimes needs to be done.
Yeah.
And they also had a big arc in Discovery in the second season. So everyone kind of thought, well, that sounds great. And then, of course, Michelle Yeoh appeared in a movie called Everything, Everywhere, All at Once and won an Oscar. I imagine all of a sudden her fee went up quite a lot.
You would think
So there was prevarication, and eventually they decided they were going to do this as a one-shot movie instead. Now, they've opened it up for more, but that ain't going to happen after this. What can only really be called a steaming pile of trash.
It's so bad. And I'll be honest with you, I didn't finish the movie. And Paramount Plus is like, you left off here. Do you want to continue? God, no. I think I'm just shy of halfway through.
Yeah, there should be a button on the streaming services that's saying, please, God, never tell me about this ever again, even though I watched some of it.
It's so bad.
So Leanne and I sat down and watched this week. We were... In fact, I thought I was just going to have to watch it on my own at some point before, because I knew we'd talk about it today. And then we were sat down during the week. There was nothing on TV. Leanne said, "You got anything to watch?" I said, "Oh, there's this Star Trek thing. It's not very good, but you know, give it a go." She went, "Okay." And even Leanne said, after 20 minutes, she said, "It's not very well written, this." So here's the problem. First of all, they took a great character who had a great backstory and really was very interesting. And they basically just sidelined everything she'd ever done to introduce something brand new.
Yep.
Right? The thing they introduced that's brand new is the most hackneyed, cliched thing you've ever seen. It combines two things. It combines, first of all, person with a dark past who, even though they're terrible, you know, committed a really terrible thing against somebody they loved and now has guilt and redemption issues about it. Yeah, which is like, it's old as the hills. And then the second thing they did is person who used to be a badass and then ran away from their job and now the job's come back to find them and it kind of talks them into it. All of these things, you just think, oh, it's been done 100 times before. But then they don't even do any of that stuff well. They do it in the most superficial, hackneyed, you know, we're going to explain this and you understand what's going on, so let's just move on now type thing. They do that all the time through this. There's an ensemble, then they do an ensemble piece, you know, the Section 31 team she gets pulled into, right? These people are so one-dimensional, it's a joke. And then having made them one-dimensional, they literally take about 2-3 minutes to introduce each character in the most clunky, let's everyone stand around and talk about who they are and where they came from and everything. They then go, oh, right, you know these people, so now you're going to care about them and their motivations and their relationships, so it's going to hurt you when people get shot or killed or might be a bad guy. And you're watching it going, I don't care. I don't know who these people are. The only person I care about is hardly on screen most of the time. And even then, she seems to be changing her motivations from moment to moment. You know, and then it turns out they're fighting for some doohickey. Yeah, it really is a complete and utter MacGuffin that nobody ever really explains what it is or what it can do. Yeah, and they're all fighting to destroy it or get it or that sort of thing. And you're just watching it and you just think, this isn't even Star Trek. And that's the real problem with it is... It reminded me very much of that Zack Snyder thing that came out last year.
Yeah, I was going to say,
remember the Rebel?
Rebel Moon.
Rebel Moon.
It really feels like a Netflix cheap sci-fi show.
Yeah, but the point is, it could have been by Zack Snyder because it wouldn't have made it any different. They didn't really use any of the backstory of the Emperor Giorgio at all. apart from the fact that, oh, she was formerly the Emperor. Even that didn't make any sense.
Well, they did apparently at the beginning. They showed her as a kid killing her friends, yeah, which made no sense.
But it didn't make sense. We know from the Mirror Universe, anybody who's seen it, is that effectively the way you become the Emperor is you have to backstab your way to the top. It's all about political maneuvering and killing people. And, you know, you've got to be more ruthless than everybody else. And they had the ruthless and the killing people. But apparently they've now retconned that universe so that they pick somebody at random. And when that person has killed everybody they've put in the ring with them, it's like Squid Game. They get to win the emperorship, and you just think, no, that's not how you in an evil universe, you know? Because why wouldn't they just kill her and continue? The Empress comes along and goes, right, well, now you're Emperor, you take over. And you just thought, what? Who would put up with that? You know,
well, movies bother me more than anything. She's the Empress now, right? Yeah. Every single time you see her as the Empress, there's no one around her. There's no court. There's no. She's by herself in a giant room. I'm like, really? This is how it works? They're just always by themselves. There's nobody ever in. It's just so stupid. I hate that so much.
But that I could put past, apart from the fact that, as I said, you know, it's obvious you don't become emperor by just being selected by somebody else and have it handed to you on a plate because of what you did. That's not the way this universe works. So to retcon that just so that they can have the, oh, you know, she slighted her lover and she thought he was dead and now he wants revenge trope, you just look at it, you think, well, that's just stupid. You've just undermined the entire universe you created.
Yeah,
you know, and if you think about it, if you go back to every other time we've seen the Mirror Universe, it just thinks, well, it undermines all of that as well. It makes it, what's the point?
It was a really, really bad movie. I don't know why it ever saw the light of day.
And then on top of that, we have some of the other bad things that again, the Snyder thing had. First of all, it had the same sort of look, kind of brown, dark.
Yep.
Yeah, it looked like it had been made by him. And, you know, that's a stylistic choice, but I don't think it's a good one for Star Trek. Yeah. And then it had no Star Trek ships in it.
None.
It had the ships it did have, they were so boxy and weird. And then filmed in such a way you couldn't even tell what they looked like. So it was really hard to tell the ships apart on the screen. And then they had these long, protracted fight sequences at speed where you couldn't really see what was going on.
Right.
You
couldn't see who was hitting who. It was so badly. It was.
Yeah.
The whole thing is a mess.
And these fights went on for about 15 minutes. And it's just like, well, why are you padding this out? You know?
Because they had nothing else. Just,
yeah. It was just vacuous. It was terrible.
Yep.
Absolutely terrible. You know, and then the only Star Trek bits they put in is they'd shoehorned, you know, some callbacks. So there's a character who turns out to be a character from Next Generation. She's going to end up being a captain in the future, right? For no good reason whatsoever. Yeah, we had a character who's a Kamaloid, which was the same shapeshifter that was in Star Trek V?
I think so.
And again, yeah, no point. And they gave him a whole load of features that apparently are new to this race because we didn't see them in Star Trek V. Yeah, we have a guy who's meant to be like an android, but he's actually they ripped off something from Men in Black, and he had a little tiny alien inside him piloting him, and he appears to be able to do whatever magic stuff he wanted if it suited the plot.
Yeah, but we're not going to talk about his accent.
Yeah, he's had an Irish accent for some reason.
Yeah,
and then we have a guy in a mecha suit, who you've never seen anybody like this in Star Trek ever before. And their only explanation for why he wears the suit is apparently he likes wearing the suit.
Yep.
You know, despite the fact he looks like a dork.
And he was dumb.
And he was dumb. You know, and then of course the main guy, they basically gave him exactly the same motivational backstory as Emperor Georgiou for reasons.
Yeah.
Oh, I think he was meant to be one of Khan's people, but I guess they hadn't got the copyright to that because they kind of alluded to him being one of Khan's minions, but didn't actually say he was one of Khan's minions. And he wasn't recruited by Khan. He was recruited by somebody else we've never heard of, because I can only presume that, there was some sort of copyright problem and they couldn't directly reference Khan.
If he was one of Khan's people, why is he so far in the future?
Well, because apparently he slept most of the time, because I'd imagine he was on the Botany Bay, allegedly. Even though that actually happened after this movie was set, because this is it's set before Kirk's time, wasn't it? Because Discovery was set before Kirk's time.
But Discovery goes way into the future, way past everything we've seen before.
She went back to Discovery's time through the portal. So I'd imagine the timeline of this movie, and it's not clear, is before the events of Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. So all of Khan's people should be stuck on Seti Alpha 6.
Yes.
Yeah?
Yep. So putting bugs why in
this guy... why this guy has come up and managed to make his way all the way into Section 31, not really clear. Who cares? Because certainly the writers didn't. The whole thing was just a mess. And as I said, the biggest problem I had with it is it just wasn't Star Trek. And I don't mind if they want to do a different genre, but you can't jettison your complete your complete location and your universe in order to do that. It's got to fit within the universe. Otherwise, what's the point? And I think I look at this and I think, what was the point? What was the point? Apparently, Michelle Yeoh got a $12 million payday for this movie.
Well, that's the point.
Yeah.
And I think they really did think somebody was going to watch this and really enjoy it. And we're going to take Star Trek in a whole different direction. And, so bad.
Originally as well, I think it was planned for a theatrical release, presumably until the executives watched it.
Yeah, and they're like, we're just going to throw this on streaming. I'm kind of surprised they didn't shelve it the way they did Batgirl.
Is it Paramount is not the same as Warner, though, isn't it?
No, but for the same reasons, for tax reasons.
Yeah, well, I think that was particularly... I think only Warner would do that. I think everyone else goes, well, we'll stick out somewhere. Maybe we'll make a bit of money on it.
So hopefully those listening to this show has not watched it and we've saved you an hour and a half. Because you do not want to watch it.
It's actually pretty rare for us to talk about something and say, actually, we recommend you should not watch this. But it really is a waste of your time.
Guy Searle basically hate-watched it.
Yeah.
Which, yeah, I get. But, so bad. It's just... it's absolute trash, so don't bother. Don't reward them with any more views than it's already got. And it's getting destroyed everywhere. This isn't just our opinion. It's universally hated. I haven't seen one review or one comment that was like, you know what, I kind of like this. This is a nice, fresh, different direction for Star Trek. No. Everybody hates it. So,
yeah.
Some news before we get into our face-off. It looks like, and I'm kind of bummed, but I'm kind of glad at the same time. Marvel is... they haven't officially said it, but it looks like they're pretty much scrapping Armor Wars. Now, Armor Wars was a comic book... I would say arc in Iron Man, where Tony Stark basically gets fed up with facing baddies that have parts of his armor technology. And he goes out, and he's just going to take it all back. And it's a big problem because some of this stuff is like in the Soviet Union or Russia and other... he goes after people he shouldn't go after, including the American government. The Guardsmen outfits, their armor, and that's American military. He goes and takes that back too. And it was a very interesting idea and concept, and it was well written. Because
it was kind of seeded into the MCU at an early stage, because a lot of the talk in the second and third Iron Man movies are about, you know, what how the US government feels if Tony Stark's tech gets out.
Well, plus they want the tech for themselves. That's what Justin Hammer's whole thing is.
Yeah, exactly. But they don't want it to get out to everybody else. And so it's about, we've got to have our own Iron Man suit, which is the Iron Patriot, Rhodey's gig. And, we want to make sure that nobody else has it. And, of course, you know, the Iron Man 3 is actually literally about Tony Stark's proliferation of suits. So, it was obvious that they would looking to do some early seeds on that, but
the idea in the MCU though was Tony's dead and Rhodey is gonna go and get all his technology back. Parting, he's gonna protect his legacy or I don't know, because obviously it's becoming a problem. So the concept there is actually pretty interesting, but I I don't know if it makes a movie or if it makes a series. It started concept as a series, then they moved it to a movie, and now it looks like they're just scrapping it because it doesn't fit in with what everything else they're doing. Which, by the way, I agree with.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think the problem is it's building on missteps they've already made, because they dropped the bomb in that terrible Secret Invasion series that Rhodey was a Skrull.
Yeah.
And it's kind of hard to then go, well, you know, he's going to go and reclaim all the tech for right and good and all that sort of thing, when actually he's an evil alien. And he was an evil one in that one.
Yeah.
So you've got to fix that. So you've now created a whole new problem for very little payoff, because much like Section 31, that TV show Secret Invasion was terrible. And really...
Probably the worst MCU project to date.
Yeah, and it really kind of screwed up the MCU, because it did so many bad things. You know, it kind of undermined Nick Fury. It killed
Maria Hill.
Yeah, it killed off Maria Hill. It killed off, what's his name, the Chief Skrull, the Friendly Skrull. Yep.
Casper, the Friendly Skrull.
You think he looks like a ghost, but actually that's just the form he shows you.
That's right.
Yeah, so... they've buggered it up, and let's face it, the MCU has been a bit of a mess at the moment. We've got the new Captain America movie coming out, and apparently that's been reworked a couple of times as well.
I have no problem with them reworking if it makes it better, but my fear is they keep showing the Red Hulk, and my understanding now is he's only in like 10 minutes of the movie.
Yeah, well, that's it. You've got to market the movie. Harrison Ford's in that role now. You know, you want to lead off that, but trailers can lie, as we well know. But the problem with the reworking is, you say rework to make it better. It's very rare that people pull that off. They normally take something that's already not great.
We don't see the original.
Oh, we hear about it.
Well, that doesn't mean shit, because, I mean, we heard that Section 31 was going to be good too, and look at that.
No. Well, yep. Yeah. I don't, when you're reworking large chunks of a movie or something like that, the problem is sometimes the rot is so bad that you can't fix it by kind of shuffling things around.
Yeah. Have you watched any of the new Spider-Man on Disney Plus? It's an animated series.
Yeah.
I watched the first, people are like either hating it or loving it, and I'm kind of in the middle. I'm like, all right, so it's definitely not the MCU Spider-Man, and that's fine, but they're taking liberties from it, which is fine. But so far, it's just kind of dull to me. I don't really care.
What came across to me is that it's just been done before and been done better. That's the problem I had with it, is that, you know, I remember some of the older Spider-Man shows. What was the one where he was kind of... He wasn't in S.H.I.E.L.D., but he was kind of semi in S.H.I.E.L.D.
Yeah.
You remember that one?
Yeah, I do.
That one was pretty good.
Yep.
And this is kind of like that, only not quite as good. And so, but again, you watch it and you go, what's the point of this? What's it trying to do?
Well, they're changing some of the characters, and I'm like, why? And then they're reconning some other MCU people, a lot of them actually, they're classmates of Peter Parker at this high school. Really? Why? So they can guest star and they can have their own origin story in the series too. It's just not well done. The writing is kind of poor, to be honest.
Yeah.
And I don't care that they made Harry and Norman Osborn black. Who cares? I don't care.
No, not bothered about that.
No. But that's where, of course, the MAGA people are like, oh, they made him blah, 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 whatever.
No. I mean, who gives a damn? I mean, Captain America's black now. Nobody right-minded should really care about that, because, you know, it's done all the time, and it doesn't matter, because people are people. It's the performance. It's the writing. It's the story.
Is not great so far.
Well, I think that's the problem. And also, this business where, you know, all of a sudden all of these characters in one single universe are all in the same place at the same time, it's so lazy. Yeah, it's just like, okay, so now we don't need to worry about kind of bringing these other superheroes in, because they all happen to go to the same school. It's so unlikely. I don't know, that's weird about when you're talking about a guy who was bitten by a spider and got spider powers.
Well, this but one, he is a magical spider, by the way, from a different dimension.
Yeah, well, I again, you know. Yeah. But it just comes across as so contrived, and then you look at contrived and you think, well, that's just lazy because they couldn't be bothered to think of a better way of doing it than bringing these characters in. And actually, it's far more interesting to bring characters in for reasons because, you know, you bring characters in for reasons, that gives them motivations, that gives them plots, it gives a rise to stories. Whereas just having them be there and just suddenly turning into the character you know, and then they have to interact with Spider-Man, it's just lazy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You put in here the Spider-Man 2 launches on PC.
Yeah, and it's not going well.
No.
And
it's a pretty graphic intensive game from the PS5.
Well, yeah, but the thing is, the same series were released on PC previously, remastered by the same company, which is the first Spider-Man and Miles Morales. And they ran great. They were really good. And they worked on pretty low-end hardware and were pretty presentable. I've played both through both of them on the Steam Deck, which is not high-end by any stretch of the imagination. And they work great. And they not only that, they work great literally from launch. There was no long wait for the stabilization patch, wait for the improvements. Oh, you know, we've got a patch coming and all of that. There was no day one patch or anything. It's just they basically launched it. And it turns out it works, unless you have literally a $5,000 PC. This game is unrunnable on PCs. I don't understand, right? The game's coming out on all the platforms at once, right? If it works fine on the PS5, then hit your date for the PS5. If it's not ready for the PC, then say, you know what, it's going to be a little bit later. People would rather wait then have a game that they pay for full price on day one, yeah, and then find they can't play it because it doesn't work. And this is not just stuttering or low frame rates or stuff like that. Apparently in some of the cutscenes, yeah, not even gameplay, but cutscenes, the graphics just destroy themselves.
Bad.
Right? So it's fundamentally broken, and they put it out anyway. And I'm just tired of companies doing this, you know?
And it's not going away anytime soon.
Well, yeah, but you wouldn't release a car that actually crashed into bridges and blew up on the first day and go, oh, well, sorry, yeah, we'll patch it. Well, I suppose Tesla does that, but most other cars would not. Most other companies would get their products right before they launch them. And yet in the gaming industry, it's become perfectly acceptable to release something that literally is unsaleable on day one and then go, oh, wait a few weeks and maybe we'll fix it. You know, and you know the first couple of patches won't fix it. They will make it slightly better, but they won't fix everything, you know. And it's just like the game wasn't ready, so why did you launch it? Why not just launch on the platforms it's ready for and then tell everyone else, well, sorry, it's not ready yet?
Well, this is probably going back to what we've talked about in the past, that marketing is driving all of this rather than, you know, when it's ready.
Yeah.
And the one company in the gaming industry that seems to be bucking that trend, quite honestly, is Rockstar. They don't say this is when it's coming out. They just say it's coming out in 2025.
Well, even Rockstar, you know, remember the remasters of GTA they did a couple of years ago? All right, it was done with a third party, but they still allowed that third party to release it when it was unplayable.
It wasn't unplayable, but some of it was not great. Yep, you're right.
Yeah,
I'm even playing Rockstar, that again, by the way.
I think the only company that doesn't do this is Nintendo. they never have to patch their games because the games work. Because they make sure they work before they release them.
Yeah.
Because they recognize that actually, no matter what your pre-order status is, if you release a game that's garbage and needs patching, then your long-term sales are going to be lousy because it's marked with the stink of failure.
Do you think Nintendo, you know, does that it this way because when they announce a game, it's pretty much already done and they're just looking for a window to slot it in? Or
I don't know, or whether they're just their development process is better, or whether whether their development process means they are far more capable of hitting a date.
No, that's with what I'm working, talking about. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, maybe they're just not lying to themselves, or because that's where it comes from. I read over last summer, I read a couple of books about game development. And they talked about, you know, and this was going back to Doom and all sorts of things. They talked about, you know, the crunch where you're getting up to release and then you have to, everyone has to start working 18, 20 hour days to get the game finished. And even then there are bits that might not work. And I mean, it's been, so when we talk about the early Doom games, you know, we're talking about something that, was happening from the 80s onwards. But the problem is now is the stakes are much higher and the costs are much higher. And what became clear from reading these books is that for some of these games, the project managers, the, you know, the lead designer or whoever, whatever the particular name in whichever studio is, are in positions where they tell people higher ups in the studios that the game isn't ready, or it needs more time, or it needs more money, or it needs more resources. And the studios turn around and go, well, yeah, but we've got to hit the date.
Yep.
You know, or they say, right, well, we can move the date, but you can only move it 6 weeks. And they go, well, 6 weeks isn't enough to fix the problems. They go, well, that's all you get. Yeah. And what that leads to is a situation, and I've seen this in my own work sometimes, is a situation where project managers just delude themselves that the date is achievable. Because basically they say, well, it doesn't matter whether I say it's achievable or not. They're not going to change the date. So I'm just going to go along with the fact that we think the date is achievable. And then we'll just launch with whatever comes out on the date. And I think that is the problem in the industry now.
Yep.
And I think Nintendo just does not do that. I think if their guys say, well, the game's not going to be ready, then Nintendo goes, fine, then we'll change the date. And so, but they're also not much better at not under-promising and over-promising and under-delivering.
Yeah, they've got a rich history of that. Let's talk about our new face-off, David, 80s.
Okay.
Before we get into this, what is the 80s your favorite decade for movies? The 90s, the 2000s, the current stuff? Well,
I don't think I necessarily have a favorite decade. I just have the stuff I like.
Yeah. Some movies are very, very dated when you watch it. Like, I love The Matrix. It's one of my favorite movies of all time. But it's really hard to watch it now with the CRTs and the flip phones, and you're like, ugh, this did not age well.
Because the problem is then it was representing what was real, whereas actually it wasn't a style. I mean, because obviously we've had stuff like Loki where they have, you know, old tech, but they're doing it as a stylistic choice.
Correct.
Rather than, whereas this is meant to represent the real world.
Yes.
I mean, you know, the very fact that large chunks of the Matrix plot revolve around payphones and
which don't even exist anymore
is kind of hard to get past. So that is a problem. I think what I particularly thought of when I looked through this list that you gave me here is that there's a lot of types of movies on here that just aren't made anymore, and I kind of miss that in some respects.
I would agree with that.
There was much more variety. There was different types of movies. There was different genres of movies. And there's also this thing where, you know, something that might look like it was, you know, kind of filler type stuff, you know, a $10-15 movie, $1 million movie that was made and, you know, with relatively low expectations for returns and suddenly blew up into something huge.
Now, some of these,
that doesn't really happen anymore.
It does, but not the way you're thinking.
Not in the same way.
No.
And some of these, you know, we have been released, and I don't think this is going to happen anymore. Some of these were released and kind of came and went and then became these cult classics.
That's what I was going to say. Some of these were commercial failures but became cult classics. And the rise of that was really the VCR and then the DVD.
Yeah, and I think the problem nowadays is that those sorts of things will release on streaming and never be seen again.
Yes.
Because the streaming services are not designed to surface up that stuff. So unless you know about it, you're never going to find it again. It's not like when you used to go to the video store and literally you'd seen all the big stuff.
Yes.
I've seen that, and you come across a movie, sometimes with an actor you recognised, and you go, well, I've not seen this. And I recognize the guy or I recognize the girl. And it's the best thing I can find today. And I need to go and get my pizza. So I'm just going to take it and we'll watch it and we'll see how it is. And then some of those were great. Some of them weren't. Some of them you watched and you thought were terrible. And then a couple of years later, you'd watch it again. It was on TV and you go, oh, that wasn't so bad. And that's how these things become the cult classics. I don't think that can happen anymore.
And also a lot of these movies, we remember because there was a theme song, or there's a part of a song that they play throughout the whole frickin' movie, and that kind of also that gets into the zeitgeist of what we're doing nowadays and how we live our lives. But let's start at the top. These are, we didn't put these, that it's not in like, this is number one C, this is number, it's not that. It's just completely random. So the first one is actually not a, this is not an easy one. They're both from 1985. The first one is Weird Science versus St. Elmo's Fire. Now, you could not pick two totally different movies.
Well,
Weird Science is considered as a comedy sci-fi, and I would think that St. Elmo's Fire is a drama comedy, even though it's not really a comedy.
Except that Weird Science was directed by John Hughes, who obviously became very, very associated with the Brat Pack.
Yep.
And then St. Elmo's Fire is probably the zenith. Most
Brat Pack, yep.
Of the Brat Pack movies, because
Joel Schumacher
just,
was the
director. Yeah, I know it wasn't John Hughes' movie, but it was it was filled with those people who were associated with the Brat Pack. Now, I've got to be honest, I love that piece of music from St. Elmo's Fire, that song, which actually was not written for the movie; it was written for something completely different.
Yep.
And they basically heard it, thought it was great, and then named the movie after it. But I always thought St. Elmo's Fire was hugely overrated for what it was. I remember watching it and thinking it was a terrible, confusing mess, and I really didn't enjoy it at all. Whereas I loved Weird Science.
Weird Science. It's so stupid. Oh. The acting is so over the top. But the science makes no sense. It's just a dumb show. It's dumb.
Well, it wasn't a show. It was a movie. Forget the show.
It's dumb.
Well, it was dumb, but it gloried in being dumb. I loved the fact it was dumb. You know, I enjoyed the fact it was dumb because I thought it played into the fact it was dumb. And so I always thought that Weird Science was underrated and St. Elmo's Fire was overrated. So
I would agree with both of those to a certain extent, but I think from a rewatchable in my 50s guy, I am never watching Weird Science again. It's just too stupid. Whereas St. Elmo's Fire actually tells an actual story. We're out of high school. We're out of college. We're going into the real world. There's actual problems there. There's, you know, good acting. Whether you like the movie or not, it's really good acting. And it does have pretty much an all-star cast. I just think it's a better overall movie. Rotten Tomatoes gives Weird Science a 60 and 43 for St. Elmo's Fire. So
there you go.
I feel like you're coming down on Weird Science. But we're going to have to do our coin flip.
I agree if we can't agree. I know you have love for St. Elmo's Fire. I know we talked a while ago about you were very excited about they were talking about doing, getting the band get back together and doing a sequel.
Yep.
Or were you fantasizing about that? I forget.
I thought that this movie or one of the Brat Pack type of movies, not necessarily this one, but would make a really good sequel. And I didn't say St. Elmo's Fire, although some of the characters are pretty good. I mean, Judd Hirsch plays this kind of a Republican guy who thinks the world's going one way. He's very much a Reagan type of kid.
Yeah.
I would love to see where his character ended up.
I'd love to see where he ended up because talk about a guy who had huge potential and disappeared off the face of the earth.
Judd Hirsch, he still does movies.
You
probably don't even recognize him, though.
No, I don't recognize him, but I'll tell you what, I don't see him in many movies anymore either.
He
was so big and he appeared to have so much potential. But I think he kind of got pigeonholed in that kind of, you know, broody rebel type character he played a lot. And at least in St. Elmo's Fire, he was doing something different. But I don't think the world was ready for it because, you know, as I say, I think we all thought he would be much bigger than he ended up being. But then a lot of the people in the Brat Pack kind of ended up like that.
I just think a movie with two dweebs that make a sex bot that they want to have sex with. It's just so stupid.
No, but that's what's great about Weird Science because it has a lot more heart than that. That is the setup. But then when the, first of all, when the sex bot is made, she, you know, she looks incredible. It's Kelly LeBrock. Yeah. But then it turns out she's the most intelligent one of all three of them. Well, and she's the one who helps them to grow.
Yes.
Yeah. But she's the one who helps them to grow. That's why I think it's a great movie, because it subverts your expectations. It wasn't. Well, there was loads of movies in the '80s like this, like Porky's and all of these kind of sex comedies. And you thought this was going to be like a toned down version of that. It turned out to be something quite different.
Yeah. Well, we're going to have to go to, because I'm definitely the same, Almost Fire, you're definitely Weird Science. So I'm gonna let you call it heads or tails. And
okay.
I'm going to click the little button on coin flip. If you do Google, it just pops right up.
You're using a digital web-based coin flip.
Yeah.
Oh.
All right, so I just flipped it. Are you on heads or tails?
Tails.
It was tails. So Weird Science moves ahead.
Yes!
David wins.
I mean, let's face it. Not going to win next time, so.
Well.
Not great loss.
The next one is an actor versus an actor, the same actor. Yeah. 1982's 48 Hours against 1984's Beverly Hills Cop. Obviously, these are both Eddie Murphy.
I mean, do we even need to talk about this?
No, Beverly Hills Cop clearly is going to, it's a way better movie.
I mean. No, it's a better movie. It's a better performance. It has a better plot. It's. Has more interesting characters. I think the problem with 48 Hours is when it came out, it was, I mean, obviously Eddie Murphy was on the up then, and he was starting to develop. I mean, Axel Foley came out 48 Hours.
Yes, no question.
Right?
Beverly Hills Cop doesn't happen without 48 Hours.
No, but I think the problem is apart from Eddie Murphy, 48 Hours is not as good a movie. I found Nick Nolte's performance in 48 Hours to be underwhelming.
Yeah, he's stunted.
It was very by the numbers.
Yeah, and he's also really racist in the movie.
Yeah,
I mean,
and he's like, you know, he's a gruff, don't give a damn cop, and he's forced into this kind of odd scenario, like an odd couple scenario.
Reggie.
Yeah.
I mean, ugh.
You know, and I think the problem for me is in 48 Hours, Eddie Murphy is doing all the work, and nobody else has turned up to play.
No.
Whereas I think that the what's great about Beverly Hills Cop is not only is obviously Eddie Murphy is the star and really is probably one of the best performances he ever did in that kind of role.
I agree.
But the fact is everybody else in that movie is having an absolute ball.
Yeah, it's fun to
watch.
They
are all completely committed to it. And every bit in it, I don't think there's any part of that movie that doesn't work at all. It is it's one of those rare movies where you watch it again and again. And I've watched it a couple of times more in the last few years. And you think, this is almost perfectly put together.
Taggart
died.
It
just completely works. Did he actually die?
Yeah, John Ashton.
Not in the movie?
No, he died in real life. John Ashton.
Yeah, well, to be honest with you, I'm surprised he lasted this long.
Last thing he did was the new Beverly Axel Foley or whatever it's called. Foley. Yeah.
But I mean he was old in this movie.
he was
came across as old.
Yeah, no, he was old.
So
But I was kind of bummed to see it. But I was also kind of glad because they did some interviews with him for the new Foley movie.
Yeah.
And he had such a good time coming back and doing this. I mean it was a highlight. And everybody was giving him praise, and you could just tell he had such a good time. And so, you know, at least he got to do that before he died. Thank goodness, because I think it wouldn't have been a good movie, or as good a movie, without him, you know?
I mean, as a series, it definitely went downhill from the beginning.
It is, and now they're talking about doing Foley's daughter, and I'm like, I don't,
nobody's
asking for that.
Put it this way, I know if I turn on the TV now and this movie is about to start, I would sit down and watch it and I would have a great time.
Yep.
Yeah, not with 48 Hours.
No, Billy is great. Everybody wanted to be Billy.
Oh, yeah.
He's so awesome. Yeah. But he didn't age well. neither did I, by the way. What I wanted, though, was Beverly Hills Cop Ghostbusters crossover. I'm sticking by that. So Beverly Hills Cop's going to go against Weird Science next time around when they meet.
Yeah.
The next one is 1984, and I didn't put these in like, oh, we're going to... 1984's The Terminator, strong movie, against 1984's 16 Candles.
this really is not a contest.
Yeah, I know. 16 candles is so much better. It holds up so much better.
Look,
here everyone, okay, you know the end of the end of the movie at 16 candles when Jake Ryan comes to her, right?
Yeah.
You know he's 65 years old now. You're welcome for that, by the way.
Well, yeah, I mean, Molly Ringwald must be getting on a bit to be honest.
But Jake Ryan is 65 years old.
I know. But the thing is that, look, I'm not going to diss 16 Candles. It's a great movie.
Anthony Michael Hall, Molly Ringwald, yeah. John Cusack. Again, Cusack.
This is a John Hughes kind of mix and sprinkle the Brat Pack in there. John Cusack is a fantastic, underrated actor. Yeah. It's a great movie, but we only really remember it because we all loved Molly Ringwald at that age. I mean, apart from that, it's a good movie, but it's not one that sticks in. If it had somebody else in it, I don't think we'd even remember 16 Candles as much as except for a footnote on John Hughes' career. Whereas The Terminator is just like iconic, you know.
How could you vote against that, you traitor to the 80s? Come on.
Well, because Arnie will be back. And he has been back several times. Again, another series, The Terminator, that... in fact, this is a weird one where the sequel was better than the original. But then after that, they all started going downhill. But The Terminator and Terminator 2 are seminal movies. And there's no way the original Terminator can beat 16 Candles. It literally blows it away with a shotgun.
I don't know. Does it really, though?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's not just the music.
You know, thank God, because that music sucks. The only thing we like about it is... Dun-dun-dun-dun.
Yeah. Dun-dun, but that's all you need. The rest of it you don't need.
I'm being facetious, of course, because Terminator is a way better movie. Yes. but I love 16 Candles when I'm in my 80s.
But we love 16 Candles because we love Molly Ringwald.
I mean, I got a little Molly Ringwald out for a while there. I was like, all right, she's not all that pretty. But, you know, out of my class. Next one. This one, I already know who's going to win because you haven't seen one of the movies. Red Dawn from 1985. This is, they redid the movie. I get it. It made money back in the day. Let's redo it with, you know, but okay. All right. But Better Off Dead is one of these released on a weekend, made for $420 type of movies. It's bad, but it's great at the same time. It has so many quotes that you've heard your entire life and didn't know was from this movie.
Yeah.
I mean, it just does.
Oh, go on. Tell me.
No. You have to discover for yourself. Because right, the whole point, okay, if you've never seen it and you're an 80s kid, you're going to watch it and be like, oh, that's where that quote comes. Oh.
Okay.
Oh. And then you'd be like, fine. All right, this is better than I thought it was going to be. This is John Cusack's coming out party. This is the movie that made him not a background character like he was in every movie up until this point, like Weird Science. It's the one that makes him who he became. I mean, I love John Cusack as an actor. I really do. He is one of my favorites.
I just said so when we were talking about 16 Candles. Yeah. I mean, I think he's hugely underrated.
Yes.
And I think he should have been a bigger star than he became. Even though, you know, some of the movies he did, I mean, Gross Point Blank is just...
It's one of my favorite movies of all time. Yeah, I love Gross Point Blank.
Astonishingly good. And I like that that other rom-com one he did, Say Anything. He was brilliant in that as well.
Yeah,
you know the one where he holds the radio.
Of course,
his head.
I do. I was thinking there was another movie I really liked him in.
The Grifters.
No, I didn't like The Grifters at all.
No,
no, it has a weird vibe that I just never really got into.
Okay, all right.
So,
but not his performance. So.
But what about Red Dawn? Do you think Red Dawn is that great of a movie?
I think Red Dawn is a crappy movie.
I do too.
But But yeah, the reason we all love Red Dawn is because the idea was so strong. The idea of, you know, a Midwest town, you know, the local football team and all of that, it gets invaded by the Soviet Union, and a group of local kids go into the woods and start becoming a guerrilla force. I mean, it's a bummer movie because, yes, you know, they all, yeah, I mean, it doesn't have a nice ending.
No.
Right.
They're all dead.
You know, they're all dead. Right. But the thing, it is quite bad in a lot of places, but I just think the idea was really cool.
I also think the actors did for what it was. Patrick Swayze, this is kind of his coming out movie. This was one of the first movies where he was the lead guy. But it still seems C. Thomas Howell is just such an intense character in here. Charlie Sheen is really good. Jennifer Grey,
yeah.
Leah Thompson, I mean, Powers Booth. I mean, there's just a lot of really good actors, and none of them overact in it, which is really easy to do.
Yeah.
But I liked Red Dawn a lot.
Don't get me wrong. I don't think it's Oscar material movie, but it was really good. And you know, it's very, very 80s. You know, when I was talking before about the type of movie that doesn't get made anymore.
Yeah.
Because if Red Dawn was made today, I know they remade it, but whatever. If they came up with the idea for this today, it would be a completely different movie. First of all, it would have a different mix of characters in. They would have a tech guy. They would have a, you know.
Well, they did redo it.
Yeah, I know that. No, I'm not talking about. I'm talking about if the idea was new today. If you went to a studio today, pretend Red Dawn never existed, or the you went back in time and stole the script so it never got made, and you took it to executives today, and you said, "We're going to make this movie," and they greenlit it. What would happen is they would have a disparate group of characters, right? They would have
It would be Oh no, David. You're saying it would be Section 31.
Exactly. That's exactly what they would do with it. In fact, they would do that. They would give you a whole load of one-dimensional characters with all different traits. They would throw them together. They would give them a very loose backstory. And then they would give each one their hero moment. But everyone would have to win. Nobody would, you know, they would kill off one character.
You say
to
make, that, but
to give
yeah,
you some emotional range.
Yeah, but you say that, but we're not far removed from Rogue One, where everybody dies at the end.
Yeah, but that was the exception rather than the rule.
I don't know. I think they're a little more braver than you're giving credit for.
I don't think this sort of movie would get made today, where everybody dies, even as they win, they die.
Did they all die in the remake? Because I never watched it. Because
watched the remake, so I don't know.
Yeah.
But the point is, when you remake a bad movie, it's still a bad movie.
Yeah.
That's the problem. And you know that what lightning they caught in the bottle that made this a cult bad movie, they're never going to get that again on the remake.
No.
Never.
Never. You don't get that.
So, yeah.
Well, I think this is a good start to our 80s movies. We've got four more face-offs to go before our winners start facing each other. We're going to do that in 2 weeks.
Yeah. Give me time to watch the ones I've missed.
There's only one in there.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's one that you really should watch.
Yeah.
But that movie, even though it's an 80s movie, actually takes place in the 50s. So anybody that knows their strong 80s history knows exactly. And it's got massive stars. This was the movie coming out for so many stars. I mean, I'm quite befuddled that you never watched that. Because it's such a seminal movie.
Yeah, I think, as I said, it's a US-UK
It's thing. Not going to beat what it's going against, but it's such a seminal movie.
And the other thing I'd say is, back in the 80s, there were a lot of movies set in the 50s. Whereas now, we don't do that anymore.
Well, no, because you couldn't tell the difference.
Yeah,
you know, 30 years ago, we're in the 90s. Okay, doesn't look a whole lot different. David, I'll see you next week for Tech Fan.
Sounds good to me.
See you then.
Bye.